This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. On the Westminster Hour tonight, we've got a series of tense hours and days ahead this week to examine and discuss. On my panel, Jenny Chapman, who's a shadow Brexit minister, so she'll be helping craft Labour's approach to Brexit as the negotiations unfold over the coming months. She's the MP for Darlington, a relatively marginal constituency, but she's back in the Commons with an increased share of the vote there. Welcome to you. James Cleverly here as well is the Conservative MP for Braintree. And James also saw his vote go up. He was a prominent campaigner for Brexit in the referendum, which took place a year ago, and was elected to the executive of the 1922 committee, the shop stewards for Tory backbenchers. Are you still on that?
I am.
Okay.
I am.
All right. Well, we'll be hearing your views on the leadership a little bit later. Ollie Grender is one of the band of Lib Dem peers who could spell trouble for the Brexit legislation when it reaches the House of Lords. She worked for Nick Clegg in Downing Street during the coalition years, and before that was a director of communications for the party under Paddy Ashdown. So welcome to you. And here as well, Sebastian Payne, Financial Times leader writer and the paper's digital comment editor. And he'll be taking us through the political week ahead, which is packed with moments to watch. But look, as we start this week, let's do it as we started last week, because the anxieties and the grief brought about by the Grenfell Tower fire and the examination it's prompted of other high-rise blocks across England, it just keeps on throwing up additional problems and anxieties, doesn't it? And Jenny, Camden has been in the news now for taking the drastic step of evacuating one block despite some residents not wanting to go. Did they do the right thing?
I think, I mean, I don't have these kind of buildings in my constituency, but if I did, or if I was a council leader in that position, I would be all over this. I think we all would. And we would want to do everything we possibly could to safeguard the residents for whom we are responsible. So I feel that Georgia Gould really, I think she has done the right thing. And I think what I've liked to seeing her do isn't just making these decisions, but getting out there in the community, explaining, listening, finding out how people feel about this. Yes, it's controversial, but having had the advice that she'd had and knowing what she knows, I don't think she had much of an option. It's very difficult. You know, I don't think there's an easy way around this. It was a tricky thing for her to do, but I think that she has done the right thing.
And we're looking at oversights and problems dating back for decades. It's not
exactly
just this government, it's previous governments as well. James, do you think, though, that the local government authorities now who are examining the cladding, you know, we're looking at, what, 60 buildings have failed the tests in 25 local authorities. And while central government says, we'll help you, is there a limit to the amount of help that central government can help these local authorities?
Well, I think we have to recognise that Grenfell Tower is a seminal moment. I think it's one of these things which is of such huge significance, both in terms of the human impact, which we've all seen. But I also think this is going to, and I hope it will, trigger a step change in the attitude towards fire safety. I think we are going to see the repercussions of this for a very, very long time. Obviously, the cladding is the thing which is in the headlines at the moment. But when
and
we see
the immediate cost of actually doing the work, the refurbs across all
but
of these buildings.
But we're also now starting to hear the other things in terms of stairwells, in terms of fire partitioning, in terms of the fire safety around refurbishments. This is a massive issue. I think certainly at this stage, it's right that people involved in this are more cautious than they perhaps would have been in the past. That's entirely appropriate.
And they'd face questions if they weren't.
Absolutely.
But what about the cost? I mean, you know, there is a practical issue here, isn't there? There is an awful lot of work now that's going to have to go on all these buildings.
Yeah, I mean, Sajid Javid has made it absolutely clear that this is this will be a priority. This is already a priority issue for the government. When we start getting the early reports out from the fire investigation teams that are on the site, and when we get the information back from other tall building inspections we see around the country, we'll start getting a better idea of what the priority responses will be. And I have no doubt at all that between local government and central government, this will absolutely be at the top of everyone's to-do list.
Ollie, obviously, we're looking at private properties as well as social housing. But you worked for Shelter in a past life, didn't you?
I did.
You know about the issues, particularly with social housing. And if there is some sort of mass upgrading of social housing needed, won't central government have to pitch in even more, despite the sort of cries of austerity?
Well, yes, and it's not just in the social rented sector, but the private rented sector. Shelter are putting out a report tomorrow, which is about all about how even more people are now in danger of being evicted from rental accommodation. So, you know, there is a massive housing problem, and that has been the case for a while. But Grenfell Tower feeds very much into that. But I also think, you know, this is if this was something like flooding or something like, you know, foot and mouth disease, the government would by now declare some kind of national emergency and deal with this. And I think we're reaching those kind of proportions. It astonishes me to discover that some of these flammable materials are not currently banned. So the first thing we ought to do is ban them. And we should do that almost before the inquiry. Especially in high rise. But I think this is now something that needs to be owned across the board. And local authorities, they've lost, you know, so much money that it is very hard for them to react. Some local authorities are really good and react immediately and put people up in hotels and do all the right things. But at the same time, this is owned across the board. This is owned over the decades, and this is owned across every party. And there needs to be some kind of national emergency response to this.
And we will be following it, because it's like peeling an onion, isn't it? You just take away one layer and then the next set of problems emerges, and that we will keep talking about this as the weeks move on. But let's step now onto the issue of the Brexit negotiations. Tomorrow we get the big reveal on EU nationals, the details of what the Prime Minister's called a very fair and very serious offer regarding those EU nationals who want to live and work in the UK. Sebastian Payne, what are we expecting tomorrow? Because the bones of this deal or this offer were laid out, weren't they, last week by Theresa May, and got a less than enthusiastic welcome in Brussels.
Exactly. Well, Brussels is looking for detail, clarity and an open, comprehensive offer here, because it's such a complicated issue here that the various iterations of things that have to be dealt with in this offer over many years and decades ahead have to all be brought together in this one offer. And we heard from David Davis, the Brexit Secretary, today that it's going to be very much like what they have now. Now, that is what Brussels does want to hear. They really don't want to see a chink of light between the rights of British citizens and EU citizens on everything except voting rights. The real battle is going to come on how is that enforced, because there's been a lot of concerns from Brexit supporters that the ECJ will still have some jurisdiction.
European Court of Justice, yeah.
Yeah, that would not go well with a clean break from the EU. But I think speaking to people in Brussels this week, if the British government tomorrow puts forward a proposal that will codify in British law in, you know, indisputable language that these rights will be as they are now on everything, you know, benefits, housing, you name it, healthcare, then that will satisfy them, because they do not want to see EU citizens treated as second-class citizens. And the government has spent a year not really saying that much on this at all. Now is their big reveal. And if it's a bit disappointing, it will raise other concerns about how well prepared it is for these other big topics like the Irish border and the money.
Which, of course, are the first issues to be discussed. How hopeful are, well, I mean, the people in Brussels, but also those who are preparing to listen to Theresa May tomorrow, that there will be a definitive sort of cut-off date announced?
Well, it sounds like we are going to have a cut-off date, and it's probably not going to be before March 2017, i.e. when Article 50 was triggered, but will be some point before we leave the EU. Now, obviously, the most generous way, if you want to put it that way, would be to put it as further in the distance as future. But the danger of that is you might get a flood of applicants or people from the EU coming to Britain, which would then increase migration numbers, which is a key concern of the May government. So we will be hoping to hear something on that. Wouldn't surprise me, though, if they do keep that a bit ambiguous for the moment, because the key thing is this about rights. That's what this is about dealing with tomorrow.
And James Cleverly, is that going to satisfy those on your benches, perhaps you yourself, who wanted a clampdown on immigration as a result of Brexit?
Hey, look, that wasn't my personal motivation for Brexit. There were probably as many different motivations as there were different voters. I was much more about our ability to trade globally. But immigration is, without a shadow of a doubt, a massively important issue around this. The Prime Minister has, from the outset, made her position very, very clear that we wanted to reassure and calm the nerves of EU nationals living here in the UK. We're very keen to do that as a priority. And I'm very, very glad that the EU27 have recognised that this uncertainty is no good for either EU nationals here or British nationals overseas, and they've forward loaded the work on this, because as Sebastian said, it is going to be complicated, but there is a recognition both here in the UK and in the EU27 that if we can nail this down early, it would be a really positive marker for the mutually beneficial Brexit that we're all hoping to achieve.
Well, as Sebastian mentioned, you know, it's a whole question about the kind of Brexit deal that you're trying to work towards. I mean, David Davis today was saying he's not 100% certain that there will be a deal. We're hearing about this emerging duo of Philip Hammond and David Davis perhaps taking over the leadership. They're both talking about a transition period. Is that how you envisage it going now? Do you think there will inevitably have to be a transition period?
I don't think it's inevitable. It depends how quickly the negotiations progress. As I say, if we can nail down some early, not necessarily easy wins, but some early wins over things like the rights of EU citizens, over intelligence sharing, counterterrorism work, and all this kind of stuff, things which are just so pragmatically the right thing to do. If we can get into the habit of agreeing things, when you do ultimately butt up against the things which are technically very difficult, if you've got into the habit of agreeing, if you've got that win-win mindset, it makes those hurdles so much easier to overcome. I'm a pragmatist. I come from a pragmatic party, and these negotiations are going to be done by pragmatic people.
Well, Jenny Chapman, I mean, you are part of the Labour Brexit team, and you heard in the news the Shadow Cabinet Office Minister John Trickett asked about Labour's position on the single market, and he didn't really answer it. He said, our policy is to secure all the rights which exist and tariff-free access within the single market and the customs union. We're not saying that their particular institutional form is something we're going to wed ourselves to at this stage. So could you tell us what is the situation regarding Labour and membership of the single market?
Well, what we want to achieve are the benefits of single market membership. Maintaining membership as we have it now is difficult, as we all know, and we've debated before, because we would be subject to all the rules of the single market around freedom of movement in particular.
Difficult.
It is difficult indeed, which is why John said what he did, because the Labour Party wants the benefits and we want the functions of the single market that we like around tariff-free trade and non-tariff barriers being removed. But we realise that that is problematic as it is. It's the functions we want, not necessarily the form.
Yes, and the manifesto committed to implement Brexit and end free movement, which Jeremy Corbyn accepts, is only possible by leaving the single market. But if membership of the single market is not something that you can say Labour's committed to, aren't you in exactly the same position? Aren't you offering exactly the same
Conservatives? The difference is that we feel that the government has lacked ambition in this and has set about the negotiations with EU partners in the worst way possible. They've started off saying, you know, we don't trust you to give us a good deal. We don't really mind if we don't get a deal. We think you want to do us harm. We don't care if we do you harm. Let's negotiate, which is a very strange way of going about this. We think if they'd set about it with maybe a bit more ambition and a better tone, particularly when you're thinking about EU nationals, we could have made some very early unilateral commitments on that. Theresa May chose not to.
The tone would have been very, very different. So
and
you're
then,
saying your tone would be different from James and that you give a different
difference.
Offer?
Well, it would make a difference because we're a year in, we're over a year in, nothing has been achieved, nothing. And that is because of the approach the government has taken.
OK, well, look, just help us then with Labour's position. For the avoidance of doubt, under Labour, we would leave the single market, yes or no?
we would be trying to maintain the benefits of the single market, but without the things that the country has said it doesn't want to have in the future. Now, if you can't do that in the single market, we would have to leave it, clearly. But if you could, if we had reformed membership of the single market, then we could stay.
And do you think that that's a possibility, to have this sort of special reformed
membership? Why not?
Membership?
Yes, I do. I do think that's a possibility. And it's something that you should, we should be trying for the most ambitious, best Brexit for Britain that we can achieve.
Ollie, do you think that it's possible to have a reformed membership of the single market, or is it single market or not single market membership?
Well, what we already know is that the 27 members are willing to be in some way flexible. They're still keen for us to stay as good partners, and so there is potential, I think. But you know, kind of we're very clear. We believe that the single market and staying in it is the right thing to do. Alistair Carmichael has tabled an amendment along those lines, and we hope that all those people in the Labour Party and the Conservative Party who agree with that will sign it. And then over in the House of Lords, Andrew Adonis has tabled a similar amendment, and he's a crossbencher at the moment, I believe.
Right. Okay.
Labour heritage.
We're working on Labour heritage.
But we all know where his heart lies. And yeah, again, in the Lords, you know, I'm hoping that there will be, especially from the crossbenchers, quite a lot of support for that.
All right. Well, now, James, you're sitting there quietly, enjoying me trying to get Labour's position. But, I mean, from your side of the fence, you have got a battle royal, it seems, going on within your party, because, I mean, you have a lot of people on your benches who do not want to go for the so-called hard Brexit of leaving the single market, leaving the customs
union. That's not hard Brexit. That's just Brexit. Because if, look, the Lib Dem position, I disagree with it, but the Lib Dem position is clear and unambiguous. Our position is clear and unambiguous.
But not Labour agreed part, across your benches,
the Labour Party's, our manifesto commitment is clear and unambiguous. The Labour Party's all over the place on this.
No, we're not.
The simple truth is that if you stay within the single market, you stay within the four freedoms, including freedom of movement. You stay under the jurisdiction of the ECJ. You might as well stay in the customs union. So if you're under the ECJ, in the single market, within the customs union, you haven't left the EU. It really is that simple. So we are going to leave these things. What we need to do is come up with a relationship which maximises our ability to trade, maximises our ability...
Why would the Europeans that you are setting out to negotiate with do that? What is in their interest
because it's just
to
as
do
much
that
in,
sort of deal?
Because it's just as much in their interest to get a good Brexit deal as it is for us to get a good Brexit
deal.
We
export 45% of our goods, and they
export 45% of our goods via the EU, not necessarily to the EU. Also, we are a net buyer of products. So although we're not the bulk buyer of EU products, we're a significant player. And also, let's forget, I mean, you know, this is not one-way traffic. The EU, the reason they're very, very keen on this divorce bill, for example, is there are a whole load of financial commitments that they have signed up to. And if Britain doesn't help pay for those commitments, someone else in the EU will have to. Otherwise, they'll have to cancel those projects.
All right.
So there's pressure in both directions, but that's how negotiations work.
Mention of transition deal. I mean, just quickly with all of you, 1 to 2 years, 4 years? I mean, we're hearing various, you know, numbers of years for this deal. What do you think, Ollie?
Well, I think, I mean, it's, the Institute for Government says even on the EU national issue, it will take 11 years to resolve all the applications that are coming through. I think we totally underestimate just how long it will take. I'm just given one example. Unstitching so many different things is going to take a very long time indeed. And a transition period, you know, your guess is as good as mine, but I think we'll underestimate it.
1 year, 2 year, 4 year?
Nobody knows. What's good and is progress, I think, is that since the election, David Davis seems to accept that there is going to be a transitional period. This is news. It's something we've been urging him to concede for quite a while. So it's good that he has. It's blindingly obvious to most people that there is going to have to be some sort of transition. What that looks like and what form that takes, I think, is a very interesting debate now. And it's something that we will be going into in quite a lot of depth, I think, in the Commons in the coming weeks.
James, could you live with a 2-year transition deal, 4 years?
I think the important thing to remember is there are lots of bits. There may be different transition periods with different elements. We keep talking about...
Oh, my goodness.
Well, no, we keep talking about this.
It's even more complicated.
Well, no, it is complicated. And we lazily talk about this as if it's a single entity. But there may be certain bits which are dealt with very, very quickly and certain bits which take longer. And as I say, we're a pragmatic party. It's a pragmatic government. We want a deal that works for the British people and works for the EU as well.
And the final thing on this, I mean, well, I'm not going to come back to you for a comment, but just to say that some people may have seen 50 Labour politicians did write to Jeremy Corbyn calling on him to fight unambiguously for membership of the single market in the Brexit negotiations. So who knows what might happen.
They're all very welcome to sign our amendment.
All right. Well, now...
Well, Andrew Adonis's amendment.
Oh, yeah. Well, as we look ahead to the coming political week, it is clear that significant moments won't be lacking. There's the Queen's speech, debate and vote coming up on Thursday, and we'll be talking more in detail about that a bit later. But another pressing concern for Theresa May, of course, is whether she can conclude a deal with the Democratic Unionists, whose 10 Westminster MPs will be crucial if she needs to get any of her measures safely through the Commons. Now, some Tories object to the deal. Here was the former party chairman, Chris, now Lord Paton, outlining his objections on the Preston programme on ITV this morning.
The DUP is a toxic brand, and the Conservative Party has got itself back into the situation where there's a danger of it looking like the nasty party, to borrow from Theresa May, making a very brave speech at a Conservative Party conference. And how that's improved by ganging up with the DUP.
John Tong is Professor of Politics at Liverpool University, and he's followed the twists and turns of Northern Ireland politics for many years. So how does he assess the chances of a deal being struck between Theresa May and the DUP leader Arlene Foster?
We're very close to a deal, and I'm fairly sure that a deal will be done. It will only be the minimalist deal. There'll be a confidence and supply arrangement, and there'll be lots of cash going to Northern Ireland. 10 Downing Street tried to effectively bounce the DUP within 48 hours of the election by saying that a deal had been done. That would be most unlike the DUP. The DUP has got long experience of taking negotiations to the wire. Dealing with the DUP is very, very tough for any Westminster government.
Why has it taken so long, though, if a deal is inevitable?
Well, the Treasury obviously was nervous about offering more money to Northern Ireland, because under the Barnett formula, if you offer more money to the devolved administration in one country, you're supposed to also offer it to the other devolved countries. And secondly, the DUP kept upping the ante. The DUP want more and more. And even if a deal is announced this week, that won't be the end of the story. The DUP will almost certainly come back for more. In effect, you've got 10 Oliver Twists in terms of the DUP's representation at Westminster. You know, they will be needy because they know they're the monopoly supplier of friends to the Conservative Party. To go into a Queen's speech without the DUP on board would be a monumental risk in terms of parliamentary arithmetic, and I don't think it's one that Theresa May would be prepared to countenance.
Well, we don't know yet whether the deal will be sealed, though, do we, by Thursday's vote?
Well, if the deal wasn't sealed, then it's possible that, I mean, the DUP could abstain and the Conservatives could just win the vote, but it's still it's a risky strategy. And frankly, to shore up the government and give it at least the impression of stability and security, I think you do need an arrangement with the DUP. The DUP do want to do a deal. The parliamentary arithmetic may never be as favourable again for the DUP, and the DUP would not want the risk of another election this autumn with the possibility of a Corbyn-led Labour administration at Westminster.
But the DUP would back the government in any vote of confidence, wouldn't they? For that very reason, that they wouldn't want Jeremy Corbyn to win.
Yes, they would, but it's a dangerous game. To offer the DUP nothing and simply call their bluff means trouble ahead, because the DUP will probably vote against the government on non-crucial votes, and the government will struggle to get any legislation through on that basis. It would only need a handful of Conservative rebels on the backbenches to threaten the very existence of this government. Much better to have a deal. And the DUP's voting bloc is reliable. The DUP as a party, if they say they're going to do something, they will deliver.
Of course, though, they could have to now commit themselves to lots of late night sittings, late votes. Who knows what might happen if we're entering a period of a war of attrition between the parties?
I think that's right. And I still wouldn't give any Conservative DUP arrangement more than 18 months anyway. I think the DUP will probably try and fill their pockets for as long as they can. And that makes sense in terms of the DUP's angle on it. But ultimately, you know, because you've still got this tight parliamentary arithmetic, you are going to have these cliffhanger votes. That's going to be a permanent feature of this government. and how long this arrangement can last, you know, the utility of it from both sides may be called into question. It would be madness for the Conservatives to risk triggering a general election in the next few months. They've at least got to survive into next year, perhaps the autumn after next, when things may look up. Perhaps the Corbyn momentum will have ended by then. And then, you know, you fixed-term Parliaments Act notwithstanding, you could perhaps call an election on then.
Not just the Queen's Speech debate and the vote on that looming on Thursday, the 29th of June, but also that deadline for talks on restoring power sharing for the Northern Ireland executive. Do you think the Northern Ireland parties between them will be able to come to a deal?
I'd be surprised if there's a deal by the deadline of the 29th of June. More broadly, though, the optimistic scenario is that Sinn Féin do desire going back into a devolved Northern Ireland executive to act as a counterweight to a Conservative DUP axis at Westminster and actually spend all the money that the DUP manages to obtain from the Conservatives. If Sinn Féin don't go back into a devolved executive, they're looking at direct rule with an orange tinge. So Sinn Féin might need the devolved executive more than Sinn Féin needed a few months ago to try and resist what's coming from Westminster. But you know, I still would be pretty pessimistic that a devolved Stormont executive, that all the issues pertaining to that can be sorted out by the 29th of June. If you look at some of the things where the parties are still apart, an Irish Language Act, same-sex marriage, whether Sinn Féin will work with Arlene Foster as First Minister, Sinn Féin has categorically said they won't. So, you know, there's still an awful lot to be resolved there, and frankly, little progress has been made in recent weeks.
So Thursday is a big day. John Tong is telling us there. He's been following this for years and he believes a DUP deal is essential before Thursday's key vote. Do you think it'll come, James?
I hope it will come. I mean,
You feel you need it. You do need it for the numbers.
We don't absolutely need it for the numbers. But as he said, nobody wants to be in a situation where you are relying on other parties not voting against you. It's much better if you know exactly what's going to happen. I think it would likely be very uncomfortable for the DUP to be sharing a division lobby with Jeremy Corbyn. I'm not going to rake through the history there, but for obvious reasons. But that said, I hope that we can work together because we want to get the government business through.
So, Sebastian, just remind us why we're talking about Thursday and why it's so important.
It's going to be a carnival of parliamentary activity on Thursday for those of us who love these sort of things. And this is
get the maracas out.
Exactly, already there. And this is the Queen's speech. So this is the first key vote for Theresa May's new government. If she gets this through, then she's, I wouldn't say running, but walking a bit quicker and is motoring towards getting some legislation passed. And the key thing is here, if they didn't get the Queen's speech through, then that would be it for Theresa May. And who knows where that could lead, probably to another general election or certainly to her ousting as a leader. And the key question here is, as we were just hearing from John, the DUP. And will they vote down a Queen's speech that could lead to a Jeremy Corbyn government? And, you know, people in Downshire are being very tight-lipped about a DUP deal. They don't want to pre-announce it because they certainly jumped the gun before. But the message they're giving to their own MPs and other MPs is very clear, which is back the PM or Corbyn will be PM by the end of the week. And that's a pretty clear thing.
And Jenny, from Labour's point of view, I mean, we heard from Ollie how the Lib Dems are planning amendments already. What will Labour do on Thursday? Jeremy Corbyn has said the Labour Party will be voting against the government's programme next week, putting forward an alternative approach. Are you tabling amendments?
Just absolutely. Give us a sense. There will be amendments. You'll have to wait and see. On the DUP...
To individual bills mentioned within the Queen's speech.
I cannot imagine for a second that the DUP are going to vote against on Thursday, because put yourself in their position. They have never had so much influence in Parliament as they hold at the moment, and they are not going to want to give that away. They want to use the muscle that they have now with their 10 MPs to, you know, get whatever they can from the government. It's going to be fascinating to see exactly where this lands. I don't expect there'll be a clear agreement in the way that we saw in 2010. This is going to be something that's constantly moving and they'll be constantly manoeuvring to try and get the next best thing that they're after.
But obviously we've got 8 Brexit bills in that Queen's speech.
Yes.
Are you going to be picking through those in particular?
Well, I think they're really fascinating because the bills, I mean, just take something like fishing as an example. What's going to be in that bill? Because how can you write a bill which is going to be subject to a negotiation with 27 other countries until you've at least embarked upon that negotiation, because what's going to go in it? And the same can be said about immigration and agriculture and customs. All of these bills, I don't think you can actually publish until we have a clearer idea of the direction that these negotiations are going to take. So the two things are going to be happening in parallel. When in the two-year Queen's Speech period we're going to see the detail, I'm not sure. I cannot see how the government can publish very much at this stage.
And Sebastian, let's mention the Sewell Convention at this point, shall we? Because just explain what it is, would you, please?
One of my favourite of all the constitutional conventions. So this is all to do with the power of Westminster to devolved parliaments here. And this all came out of the creation of the Scottish Parliament in the late 1990s. And essentially, it says Westminster will not legislate on matters to devolve parliaments without the thumbs up from those devolved administrations. And there was a big question. We had the Article 50 Supreme Court case, whether the Scottish Parliament would have to be involved. And the Supreme Court said then, well, actually it doesn't. But with the repeal bill, previously known as the Great Repeal Bill, both David Mundell, the Scotland Secretary, and Theresa May have said that MSPs will have to have some kind of tick process on the repeal bill, because it will directly affect the roles and the power of the devolved Parliament. And that could be a big flashpoint for Brexit negotiation, Brexit legislation.
All right. Well, while you're on your conventional role, tell us about the Salisbury Convention, and then I'm going to ask Ollie about her role in that.
Well, let's go even further back into time to 1945, and this convention is all about the House of Lords and the House of Commons. This was when the Labour government came and had a very radical programme for government, which the Conservative peers didn't really like that much, but they said this is the will of the people, and on big manifesto commitments, the House of Lords will not vote it down. That's the convention. But the key thing word here is that it's not a law, it's an agreement. And some Labour and Lib Dem peers, maybe Ollie might agree with this, will say that actually Theresa May doesn't have a mandate on Brexit because she didn't win a majority, and they argue the convention doesn't apply, so they don't have to give things the second reading that we would normally expect.
And is there no definitive ruling on it so far?
Having spent a lot of time reading into this, there is not actually, because because it is not enshrined in laws. But I think this is probably going to be put to the test over the next 2 years.
Well, this is longer term then, isn't it? And Ollie, I mean, are the Lib Dems now flexing their muscles? You know, there's a large number of you in the House of Lords,
yes.
Increased number in the Commons, but in the Lords, are you planning to
We're kind of just over proportionate to our percentage share of the national vote in the Lords. Yes, well, you know, the Salisbury-Addison Convention
To give it its full title
was a bit of a stitch up between Labour and the Tories, and we've never agreed with it. But in particular in this Parliament, Theresa May asked for a mandate and didn't get one. And therefore, I think this is all up in the air. And you can talk conventions until you're long in the tooth. But I don't think the Lords will sit happily with that. Also because if the government makes the mistake, which it does quite often, of trying to force through a lot of secondary legislation without proper scrutiny, and I think there's a serious danger of that, that makes crossbenchers very, very grumpy indeed. And they sometimes rule the roost in the Lords.
Well,
I mean, it'll make us grumpy too, but with the crossbenchers, it's very tricky.
Your potential new leader, we haven't had the leadership contest yet, but Vince Cable said that you can and should be disruptive. As a former military man, James Cleverly, are you ready for the battles of attrition ahead? Because, my goodness, there will be guerrilla warfare aplenty, won't there? Lots of late nights, lots of late
there
votes.
There's going to be lots of hanging around. There's going to be lots of waiting for votes that probably then don't materialise because negotiations have gone on behind the scenes. There's going to be lots of to-ing and fro-ing. This is going to be, for political anoraks all over the country, this is going to be a fascinating period. Because, like Sebastian there. This is going to be a fascinating period because it's complicated and it's going to be difficult.
But it's going to be tense for you because, as I mentioned, you know, there are some on your benches who will quite happily on certain issues team up with Jenny and with Ollie and their parties
if they're unhappy
with the Brexit stuff.
I don't think there are going to be many people who would happily team up to vote against the government.
Take happily out of it.
Because,
who would team up?
Because, of course, now voting against the government is really the nuclear option. When you've got a larger majority, you can do that with a degree of impunity. You can get, you know, you can have a bit of a sharp conversation with the whips afterwards. They'll tell you how very disappointed they are and how can we make sure this doesn't need to happen again. But when you're in a minority position, as we are at the moment, then voting against the government is a really, really big act. And I think a lot of people will be very careful before they do that.
And Jenny, are you reaching out to the yes. Conservatives? And are you aware of some of them who are coming across and who will vote with you on certain issues?
It's informal and it is too soon to say. I mean, James quite rightly says that when it's close, people will think much more carefully about it. But that can work both ways, because yes, there'll be pressure to be loyal to Theresa May, but there'll also be pressure to do the right thing. And Theresa May will know this, and she will know the attitudes of some of her people sitting behind her. And I think that will change what she presents to Parliament in the first place, because she won't want too many knife-edge votes if she can avoid it. We'll be trying to get knife-edge votes, and we will be putting amendments down to try and force her hand. But I think that backbench Tory MPs will feel the pressure from whips, but they'll also feel the pressure from their constituents.
I think the fascinating thing is going to be lowest common denominator will be reached in the Commons, and therefore I'm not entirely certain there will be a lot of work as there usually is in the Lords.
Right, we'll talk a bit
way
more.
Of putting it.
We will talk a bit more about that. Now, the general election seems to have brought about a reversal of fortune for the Conservative and the Labour leaders. Theresa May's future is, of course, the subject of much speculation, whereas Jeremy Corbyn, despite coming second, is being hailed in some quarters as the winner. He got a rock star reception at Glastonbury yesterday as he took to the pyramid stage, attracting a huge crowd of people, many wearing T-shirts bearing his name. Where does all this leave the Labour Party at Westminster and beyond? Well, our reporter Faisal Farooq has been seeking the views of activists and politicians.
So it's a warm summer evening and I've come to a nightclub in North London. Now, this is not the kind of place where you'd expect to find your average political activist meeting, but the hall is packed with people of all different ages, looks like all different groups, and I'm here because Momentum, the campaigning group, are holding a activist rally to reflect on their successes on the general election.
Good evening. We're going to be talking about our post-general election strategy, but let's be honest as well, we are celebrating as well, aren't we?
My name is Bethel Strog. I am 20 and I am Momentum's membership organiser. During the general election campaign, we managed to get hundreds of thousands of new people who had never been involved in politics before, involved in the Labour Party's canvassing, door knocking, in Momentum activities. That's an incredible energy that we can build on.
Momentum isn't officially part of Labour, but it has over 26,000 members and is requiring them all to join the party. Jeremy Corbyn's leadership has seen Labour's membership rocket, but that's creating pressure for the party to change how it does things. For many activists, the right to have more of a say is obvious. Emma Rees is Momentum's campaign officer.
We've seen over the last 2 months what the value of having a mass membership party is. And, you know, we're the largest political party in Europe. And that's because you can have all the money in the world, but if you haven't got people in communities to go out and knock on doors, to talk to other people, to talk to their friends, their co-workers, you know, to send Facebook messages or WhatsApp messages to everyone that they know on polling day, that's the stuff that you can't buy. And I think that the Labour Party has to represent its members and it has to embody the values and principles of democracy and participation.
Veteran left-winger Ian Lavery was made Labour's party chair in the post-election reshuffle. He's sympathetic to that argument.
I do believe that the members of the party should have more say in what happens. What we've got rules and regulations in place at this point in time. If people think there's something we need to change there, we need to do it through their democratic processes. And, you know, we've got nearly, I think, 500,000 members. It's huge, you know, it really is. One of these challenges, a great challenge, is to try and keep these people enthused.
Giving grassroots members more say on policy and parliamentary candidate selection are just some of the possible changes. There are also long-rumoured plans to lower the threshold for nominating leadership candidates and replacing key party staff. But it's argued that these changes risk exacerbating internal divisions. Richard Angel is the director of the centrist think tank Progress, once at the heart of New Labour.
provocative acts of undermining the deputy leader, trying to bring in a second deputy leader, trying to deselect MPs, change the party rules, change how we elect future leadership elections, will all be things that fracture the internal unity that the party now has and led to much of that success, but equally would send a message to the public that the Labour leadership is more focused on refining the party internally, not focusing on their big concerns.
Some fear this would amount to a domination by the leadership and organised groups within the membership. At the Momentum event I attended, speakers called for the democratisation of the party, and it was clear they wanted a recalibration, towards the leadership and towards the left.
Come in, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Paul.
We'll go up in my office, it's a bit quiet.
I paid a visit to journalist and Corbyn supporter Paul Mason, who doesn't think that's a problem.
Look, you can't have a party that's on the edge of power where the leader of the party doesn't control the main organisational functions and institutions. So Corbyn struggles to get a majority on the NEC. He struggles to get what he wants to happen in the Southside HQ, and has done for about 18 months. This has to change because within 3 months, 4 months, I think the May government could collapse and will be in power. Now, how can you have a party that is seriously asking the electorate to put it in power when there's almost a dual power at the heart of the institution itself?
Ian Lavery now thinks it's time for MPs and others to accept the leadership and the route it wants to take.
People within a party like the Labour Party, of course, I think we should remain as a broad church. But there are issues with individuals, which I'm not prepared to name, where they need to make their mind up. They either want to be a part of the Labour Party or they might choose to be independents.
Bristol West MP Thangam Debonair, previously a critic of Jeremy Corbyn but now a Labour whip, thinks the party needs to reflect more on the election results before deciding on its future direction. She thinks Brexit, not just the manifesto, contributed to Labour's performance.
I think it would be really helpful for all of us in the Labour Party, from the leadership down to all the members and the parliamentary Labour Party, to be really conscious of the fact we don't know in detail why so many people voted Labour in certain seats and not in others. We're only just beginning to analyse that. In my own constituency, there were a range of reasons. One of them was Jeremy Corbyn, but one of them was Brexit and opposition to Brexit. And that came up for a lot of my colleagues in other seats as well.
And it's Brexit that touches on the dilemma of whose voices the party should heed. Thangam is one of 50 Labour politicians who are pressing the leadership to now fight to stay in the single market. But that might not help in the party's traditional working-class heartlands, where the Conservative vote share actually grew. Len McCluskey is Unite the Union's General Secretary and a key Corbyn supporter.
Yeah, I do recognise it as an issue, and it's undoubtedly centred around the whole issue of Brexit and the question of migrant labour, the collapse of the UKIP vote, of course, which to an extent went to the Tories, not completely. I'm comfortable with the Labour Party's current position. I think it's the correct position, and I urge any Labour MPs to support that position.
Labour is now left with a dilemma, keeping new supporters on board whilst reaching out to its traditional vote. This weekend, Jeremy Corbyn's name rang out across Glastonbury Festival, and it seems the party will have to grapple with whether it's the voice of the leadership, the parliamentary party, the membership, or the voters that is heard the loudest.
There we are, Jeremy Corbyn at Glastonbury, Faisal Farooq there. Jenny, there were some of the concerns, some of the enthusiasms and optimism, but concerns as well about what may happen in the months ahead. And with all these votes coming up on Brexit, if backbenchers within the Labour group get they decide that they want to vote against the line that's been put forward by Jeremy Corbyn, for instance, will they then get accused of plotting against him? Will they be trolled by his supporters? Are they allowed to express a personal view now the issue of the leadership's pretty well settled?
Well, first thing is there will be Labour backbenchers who will vote against because they feel incredibly strongly on this issue. I respect that. I know that Keir Starmer respects that, and I know that Jeremy Corbyn respects that. Will they then get accused of plotting, probably they will be subject to some of that because that's life. And in politics, that kind of goes with the territory. It's wrong. It shouldn't happen, but it will. but they're big boys and girls and they can take it. And I think we all know that this is an issue that people have strong views on. They're not about to give those views away and stop holding them anymore. You know, this is something that in the Labour Party, as in the country, which is one of the reasons why our position actually worked for us at the last election, is because the views in the Labour Party pretty much mirror the country. And,
yeah. And Jeremy, you know, Corbyn was a serial rebel in his time as well, so he should, you know, allow you to do
politics
it.
Politics is about wanting to change things, holding a view, expressing your view. The Labour Party isn't a crazy sect or a cult or something. It's something that is a broad church with individuals with different points of view, but who broadly want change, who want an end to inequality, who want opportunity for everybody in this country. And that's what we're going to, that's what unites us, and that's what united us at the election and why we made the progress that we did.
James, after that election, Jeremy Corbyn is safe in the leadership. The same can't be said for Theresa May, can it? Do you think she'll be gone by autumn conference?
No.
Because she's obviously had an awful lot thrown at her, hasn't she?
She's had a horrid month. The back half of the election campaign and the period immediately after, and she's held her hands up. Some of that is down to her own fault. Some of it is circumstances beyond her control. She's had a shocking month, but every time that Theresa makes a decision which steadies the ship, shows forward progress, she makes her position more secure. I think it will be...
So this talk of an interim leadership, perhaps, of David Davis and Philip Hammond all the other way round, the assumption being, of course, that they are the only two grown-ups in cabinet who could take on the leadership. No, there isn't anyone else, is there?
I don't think either of them. I mean, I know them both, and certainly neither of them are making noises about that. If there are some hot-headed backbenchers who are doing a little bit of freelancing, well, that's up to them.
They're the only two names in the frame.
No,
the
name in the frame at the moment is Theresa May. She's the lead and she's staying put.
Weren't you a supporter of Boris Johnson at one point?
Yeah, well, he didn't get elected as the leader of my party.
So his moment's passed.
I respect the decision that the party made. Theresa won with a very, very
party
comprehensive...
Party didn't make the decision, though.
The parliamentary party, who chose her with a very, very powerful mandate. And as I say...
All right, OK. Now, Ollie
Keep
Grender...
Moving forward. Keep moving
forward. Lib Dems have got a leadership election coming up. Vince Cable's the only person who's put his name forward yet. Do you think he will remain the only candidate?
Well, I think we've just heard why a coronation is a very bad idea and why a competition is a good idea, because you need vision, ambition, policies all tested thoroughly rather than simply someone going through to the leadership, because Gordon Brown and Theresa May have proved that that never works. I'm hoping that Ed Davey will stand. If he does, I will support him, but we'll wait and see.
All right. Well, now I'm going to give Sebastian Payne 1.5 minutes of uninterrupted time to run us through the front pages. Go for it.
So we've got a couple of big stories here. The first one is back to Grenfell, which is the cover of the Daily Mirror, and the item, which is 100% unsafe, is the line they've both gone for, which is all the counter tower blocks tested in the wake of the disaster have failed the safety checks. And this just shows the scale of this that we're facing. It's not just one dreadful tragedy. It's an issue that's going to affect the whole country and housing policy, I think, for many, many years to come. But obviously, as often happens, this thing becomes quite political. And the front page of the Daily Mail, they've gone back to attacking Labour in quite powerful language. And it's furious Labour cause tower fire murder. And this is comments by John McDonnell, who said that the Grenfell tragedy was murdered by political decisions, which is some very strong language from the Shadow Chancellor there. And Nadine Dorries, a Conservative MP, has rebutted that pretty strongly.
Well, she said it would have been nice if he'd let the dust settle, bodies be identified and given people time to grieve before he played politics. Indeed, a quote from her.
Indeed, and I think these issues are inevitably political by their very nature, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of to and fro over the next couple of days, particularly as the Commons comes back.
And then finally,
we've got the EU citizens issues we were talking about earlier, which both The Times and The Telegraph have splashed on. The Times has got foreign criminals to be thrown out after Brexit, but that the minister will keep paying 155 million medical bills for Britain in the EU. And find the Daily Telegraph is the same again. Healthcare pledge Bridge for UK tourists.
Marvellous. Sebastian, thank you very much. James Cleverly, Jenny Chapman, Ollie Grender, thanks to all of you as well. Join us again at the same time next week. For now, from all of us here at the Westminster Hour, good night.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.